Welcome to the Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, ladies, gentlemen, and everyone else that's not in that category. Welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Ms. Sarah Gowan. Sarah, how are you?
No, well, and you?
And Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm okay. Yeah, I think, you know, your tone of voice just sums up my feelings.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to spark you with life in our own enthusiastic discussion that is sure to follow.
I doubt it.
Well, let's start off with, I think, my favorite story of the past couple of days. And this is that the SABC is thinking of is pushing for a Netflix license, so to speak. So here's what's been going down. The Communications Deputy Minister, Pinky Kakena, told Parliament's Portfolio Committee on Communications this week that the definition of TV license in its current form was archaic and should be amended to include other electronic devices such as laptops and tablets. Regulation is needed on pay service providers like MultiChoice and subscription video on demand providers like Netflix to collect TV licenses on behalf of the SABC, similar to municipalities collecting traffic fines and motor vehicle disc fines for motorists. The definition of TV license is outdated and needs to be adjusted to current realities. This is hoped, this is what she said, this is hoped that it will be able to bail out the SABC, which is reporting a net loss of around 500 million rand last year, and will probably be more this year. She went on to say, we also have other platforms where people consume content in all of those areas. That is where we should look at how we are able to get SABC license fees for those gadgets. She also proposed that commercial TV broadcasters with more than 30 channels should be barred from carrying SABC channels while also caring for sports channels to be offered at affordable rates. So I'm not sure who to start with here. Herman, a TV license for Netflix.
It's very, very dangerous for me to unmute myself now, because the minister can really off. I just muted myself, you know, strategically there. It is just absurd. It is a government just, you know, pointing at things, saying, let's tax that. Let's tax that. It just boggles the mind to say that, you know, because we failed, in providing a service that people are actually already paying for, because we failed, we need to now just at random identify things that the government can use to generate some form of income. It just is incredibly annoying. It reminds me of a Margaret Thatcher quote where she said, you know, put your money in a bank and they'll nationalize the bank. Put your money in socks and they'll nationalize socks. I just feel like that's the level we are at here, that despite getting billions, hundreds of billions of rands of taxpayer money over the years, despite essentially having a monopoly on entertainment for the vast majority of this country, despite all that, the SABC can't even manage turn something off. You know, it doesn't even have to turn a profit. It just needs to stop losing hundreds of billions of rands. And now, as ever, the ANC, the government, is just going to make their failures the problem of ordinary South Africans. But, you know, the philosophical thing to one side, I'd like to see them try this. Genuinely, I would like to see them practically implement this, because I don't know if the minister or the deputy minister is aware of this thing called VPNs.
Indeed. It reminds me of, actually, there's a, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, but there's a clip from the Libertarian Party in America in 2016, where they were arguing about whether there should be licenses for cars. And one of the candidates, who looks a bit odd, stands on the stage and says, if we have licenses for cars, what's next? A license for using putting toast in your own damn toaster? And one would it's sort of, a lot of people laughed at this, but I'm actually thinking maybe the ANC will go there next. Sara, what's your take on this?
And I've just bought a new toaster. You see, I think other than the sheer absurdity of trying to license other entities in order to provide revenue for the SABC, which is really just sort of bled our money, frankly, is the fact that, you know, it followed the English model of the public broadcaster. And even in England, you know, there's a lot of scrutiny on the BBC. Now, either because of changes in technology, tastes, fashions, etc., we don't actually have the space for a public broadcaster, or to the extent that we do, it is, as you say, it's got to break even, and it's got to do entirely what it is supposed to do, and that is service the public. It is not there to make all its political talk shows that people phone into, like the private sector. It is not meant to compete with the private sector. It is not meant to look for advertising like the private sector. It must just work within the budget it has. Otherwise, it may as well not exist. And of course, the most outrageous thing of all the zillion of outrageous things that Shirley did in his reign, he sold off, I think it was to MultiChoice, the archives of the SABC, which were worth over R1 billion. Apparently, the most extraordinary set of archives probably anywhere in the world. And now we've got to bail these people out when actually the only people who listen or watch them are those who don't have an alternative. So, but to try and interfere with these modern functional businesses that supply viewing material to us, it's a joke. I mean, it just is a joke. I mean, it's more ridiculous than the toll roads.
I think there's a bigger issue here. So I'm glad you brought up the toll roads, and I want to connect this to something Herman just said a few minutes ago, which is you said, Herman, you'd like to see them try. And practically, right? So let's say you needed a license for everything, for cell phones, for laptops, whatever. The incentive for a lot of people, I think, is honestly just going to be, particularly poorer people, to go outside the law to buy unlicensed goods, to not pay their license fees, that kind of thing. So it's going to turn the whole country, in effect, into a nation of people who tax dodge on one level. This is probably not a scenario that the government wants to encourage. And I think psychologically this does a number of things. It reminds me of exactly how things went down in Greece. People, you know, politicians misspent money. So people said, well, then we won't pay our taxes. But people still wanted the benefits. And then you had the sort of death spiral where no one paid their taxes, but everyone wanted their benefits, and everyone hated the politicians, and the politicians hated the people. Herman, do you think that this is sort of, you know, going to psychologically, if they tried something like this, it would sort of change the psychology in the way I've described?
I don't know, actually, because I'm not. I don't have the facts at hand to know to what extent, South Africans will be affected by this. Your middle class will obviously be largely affected by this.
Well, we know that cell phone usage is extremely high in South Africa's population. I think we have more cell phones than people in South Africa.
Yes, we do. But you've kind of got two conversations going here, or the minister kind of implying two things. Either you can tax competitors to the SABC to make up for the shortcomings of the SABC, or you can tax more broadly any possible device that you can, access entertainment media on. So in the one case, if there's a Netflix tax, I'm not sure, it will get the people out on the streets. But if it bleeds over into this absurd idea of, anything with a button and a screen, from a television to a microwave, needs to be taxed, then I do think you might see just not necessarily anger, just apathy, just a kind of a point and laugh ridiculousness at the ineptitude of a government just so terribly desperate to get its money on things. But the actual issue here that it's just government is just making it more and more difficult for South Africans to even, you know, sustain the vaguest hint of an illusion that it is worth paying taxes in this country. And I'm not advocating for a tax revolt, not because it's illegal, but it's illegal to advocate for it. That's why I'm not advocating for it. Were it not illegal, who knows what I would do. But the issue here is that you are breaking beyond parody any semblance of a relationship between a government and its people. But Nick, I just have to pick you up on one point today. You know, a government that through regulation makes criminals of countless South Africans, I mean, that can't happen. Hang on, sorry, drinking and smoking and COVID-19 and all of that, and Mbeki Cele being proud of having arrested 250,000 people who dared inhale a bit of a fag. My goodness, it's just, the lockdown showed us so much about how the inept idiots at the top of government regard power and what they may do with it. And if they can, on the smallest, you know, conservative, traditionalist, patriarchal whim, say no drinking and no smoking, soon, I mean, bars will be more boring than libraries. You know, because it might be no smoking, no drinking, and no talking. And then you have this spillover of just the insanity of pointing at stuff and saying, well, we're failing, that thing isn't failing, let's take its success. It's a fundamental exposure of the ideological idiocy and socialism of this government.
Indeed. I think it's also another excellent example of the vampire state, that is a state that gives very little and takes a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen the SABC is kind of, you know, this moribund big organization, and now finally beginning to see people being able to get around it and get entertainment from a lot of other places. You know, MultiChoice is pretty big. There's small alternative stations that service poorer communities, and even MultiChoice does now as well. You know, there's things like Netflix, which are relatively cheap, so even the sort of lower middle class can get access to it. And then government steps in and it starts trying to regulate everything to strangle it in the crib, so to speak. And I fear the same thing might happen to internet infrastructure, which for years was held up by Telkom's incredible slowness and sluggishness on rolling out infrastructure. And then fiber came in and suddenly the middle class had access to world-class internet speeds. Herman?
But Nick, it's also one thing that I have to say is that the socialist oftentimes justifies, you know, from each according to his means, to each according to his needs, by kind of creating this idea that, you know, take from the rich and give to the poor. That is not what's even happening here. I mean, these socialists are so inept, they don't even have the fallback of at least some semblance of a moral high ground, saying we're going to tax Netflix because Gogos don't have radios or television.
Right, and we've seen exactly with COVID relief what happened when they said that.
Yes. So the thing is, this isn't even, you know, some form of vaguely moral socialism of ye good olden days, you know, your Neville Alexanders of the world. This is just blatant crony thievism where they just, you know, they just make people pay for their own mistakes. There isn't a moral argument here to say we are going to help the poor with this. The only people they want to help are the people in their own, you know, patronage network, the lubrication of which is slowly but surely coming undone.
Indeed. Right, let's move on to our next story now. And this actually began, I believe, with a tweet from the finance minister, Tito Mboweni. So he was supposed to give his medium-term budget policy speech, I think, tomorrow, or at least this week, but it has been postponed. He requested more time, so it will be delivered next week, and we're expecting a bit of financial fireworks when the speech is made. Anyway, he tweeted out a picture of him in a Zoom call with some of his what he called core speech drafting team. And people noticed that one of the people in the group was former Anjani Musamani. Anyway, my bad pronunciation aside. So she's an interesting character, right? She was a former senior journalist for the Tiso Black Star Group. I think she also may have worked for the Daily Maverick. There was a bit of backlash on social media saying, what is this sort of former journalist doing? She was also implicated by a senior Hawks officer at the State Capture Commission in 2019, who claimed that she was had a, basically a car paid off to the tune of 140,000 Rand from a slush fund of crime intelligence. In 2007, she managed a page called The Friends of Jacob Zuma, and she had been very involved in ANC internal politics. The Treasury responded that she had been appointed as a community outreach officer and that it is the prerogative of the ministry to appoint whoever he wishes to his team as per the prescripts of the ministerial handbook. Sara, what should we make of this?
I'll give Ranjini Munisami some credit. She is the ultimate sort of comeback kid. All those things you've mentioned of what happened have happened to her, but the most striking, and I certainly remember it, was when she went from mainstream media journalism to suddenly becoming a praise singer for Zuma. As things started to become apparent about the nature of his of his reign, shall I say, and her credibility went down the tubes, because I mean it was literally working for Zuma, and Zuma then just eventually sort of pretty much crashed and burned. Took a while, all our resources have gone with him, and then she went back to mainstream journalism. So this doesn't really entirely surprise me, but there are two things that do surprise me. One is that does she have the sort of know-how or skills to be of assistance to the Ministry of Finance, despite her varied past? And what on earth does the Ministry of Finance need a community outreach officer for? I don't want to be entirely cynical, but in the absence of some explanation on that score, I'm going to stick with my cynicism.
Apologies. Her name is pronounced
Munusami. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know why.
You told me before you practiced it like three times and then your tongue got caught. But I mean, the only thing getting caught in South Africa is about, you know, tongues, because Munisami, I mean, in any sensible, vaguely, aspiring democracy, someone implicated to the tune of 140,000 rand in the biggest, you know, exercise of you can either see it as the biggest exercise of, you know, governmental self-pleasuring, or you can see it as a big exercise in the exposure of corruption. But anyhow, someone explicitly mentioned in these kind of investigations, then becoming intimately involved in the drafting of the Minister of Finance's speech. I mean, unless she is there to give input on how to get vehicle finance in the medium-term budget policy statement, I'm not sure what on earth she's doing there. This is such an undermining of Tito Mboweni's Mr. Clean reputation. Munisami is as compromised a journalist as it is possible to find in this country, and blatantly so. Why on earth is the great integrity having hope of, you know, of so many in the media, you know, the great Twitter chef Mr. Mboweni, who I think is probably, you know, a nice and jovial and charming guy, but what on earth is he doing with people who are so blatantly aligned with the very faction that Tito is supposed to be the nemesis of? How can anyone have faith in anything the ANC does? Either Tito Mboweni appointed this inept, journalist in quotation marks to help him write his speech, in which case his reputation and his judgment is highly suspect, or he did not appoint her to his team, and she was foisted on him, in which case it's a question, if he can't decide who writes his speech, never mind, you know, him deciding where the money is going to come from or what financial or economic policy in this country will be. No matter how you spin this, this is such a tragic window into the poisoned or compromised soul of one of the supposed great hopes of the Ramaphosa New Dawn. It is just vile. It just makes my skin crawl, the whole incestuous patronage network, how it all just, you know, have each other's backs. And meanwhile, here we are, ordinary South Africans, being told over the next 3 years we're going to pay another 40 billion rand in tax. And just the last point from my rant, the response by the Treasury, by the minister's people, saying, you know, it's at the discretion of the minister who he appoints. That is such, I mean, you that is such a panicked puppy sitting next to a pile of poo kind of response, going, oh my goodness, you know, don't ask us questions, we can do whatever we want. So all of this just stinks to high heaven of either a lack of integrity or just a lack of skill. But I always thought that if this country was going to be brought down by a Tito Mboweni tweet, I thought it would, you know, something, it would be something regarding an absurd amount of sardines and garlic. Never did I think we would have something that smells even worse.
I think what's also interesting about Ms. Munasami's career trajectory is how it really shows why there are serious incentives on a lot of people in civil society and business and the media to get very close to the ANC and to become part of the patronage network. You know, she was close to Zuma for a very long time, and it seems to have paid off, right? After she was basically, you know, had these big scandals and is described by IOL News as, you know, disgraced former Sunday Times journalist. She's managed to land, apparently, with both of her feet on the ground in government.
Landing on both of her feet in a position where she influences the billions and billions and billions of rands that is, you know, managed by government. Not just, you know, she's all right somewhere in some second-rate city. She found a small little, you know, coffee house that does all right, okay business. She's in the core team, to quote the minister, the Politburo of who is actually writing the most important medium-term budget policy statement in a decade. It's just, it boggles whatever is left of my mind.
Right. And I think it's exactly why, you know, when people ask, why is everyone being so nice to government? Why are people sucking up? Why do people always bend to the ANC? Well, it's because you can get a very big parachute, which can save you from a lot of trouble. Anyway, let's move on to our last story of today. And that is, I think, you know, the US election is getting closer now. And we've talked a bit about the US election over the past couple of weeks. And I think the question does need to be asked, who is going to be the better candidate for South Africa? Is it going to be Joe Biden or Donald Trump? And I also guess it depends in, you know, how you define what is good for South Africa. So, Sara, let me start with you. The candidates, I think, have been quite coy with that. You know, they're often in these campaigns, they don't give a lot of specifics on what their policy might be. We've seen so far that the Trump administration has, South Africa's not been a particular priority, but it's criticized. Mark Pompeo criticized farm murders and expropriation without compensation, or rather Mike Pompeo criticized expropriation without compensation. Trump criticized farm murders, and there's been some talk of kicking South Africa out of the trade deal we have with the US, AGOA. Biden's played his cards a bit closer to his chest. Can I ask you to speculate wildly on who you think might be better for South Africa?
I think holding cards closely to one's chest is a synonym for having not thought about it at all and doesn't give a damn. And I think historically, I can't go into much detail because I can't remember offhand, but I actually think Republican presidents have by and large been better for South Africa than Democrats have been.
Right. Now, what's his name? George W. Bush's PEPFAR program gave an enormous amount of money to HIV AIDS prevention in South Africa and actually funded a lot of antiretrovirals.
Exactly, and then only they only got a bit pissed off when they discovered that a lot of the money was being misspent. So there is that strange paradox, but I don't think much will change. I mean, the very fact that they even commented on things like EWC, I mean, we haven't had a lot of foreign societies their leaders commenting, criticizing, or anything else. So they've been firm on that. They want to kick us out of AGOA. We probably, by and large, deserve it. And it's probably that threat, not so much the actual kicking out, but the threat of kicking out, that is the only thing that will get us to do the right thing. Because this self-same government that the chairman's got his knickers in a twist about is a government that's done things, and we're not, irrespective of what the American side may be, but we can't afford to do egregious things to America or piss them off or whatever it else it may be. And we have done that with AGOA. So we deserve to be slapped on the knuckles, and maybe it is the way to get us to do things. I think the Democrats won't even do that. They'll probably just essentially humor us. I don't think we're going to see much of what we need from the biggest economy on the earth, and except perhaps maybe we'll be reminded that we are one of the most relevant economies on the earth. So I'm not convinced that the sort of left-leaning Democrats are necessarily going to be of any benefit one way or the other to South Africa.
Herman? Who do you think will be better?
Well, I think Sarah's point about Republicans being better for Africa is absolutely on point. But I can sum up my view as to who I think will be better for Africa and South Africa by making two simple points. One is, if victimization or if victimhood ideology wins the culture war globally, then Africa, in many senses, are, you know, what I told the deputy minister to do earlier in the podcast. So that's the one thing, is we are in a situation where if victimhood starts dominating every single conversation about what is good for a community or what is good for a society, it's the end of any hope for Africa. Africa could go from being, you know, the place with the greatest potential for growth over the next 50 years to being even worse than it is. It is victimhood mentality and socialism and corruption and warlordism that has gotten Africa to the state where it is, and has done so effectively over the last 50 years. So that's the first thing, is I think the left in America drives a victimhood ideology in the form of critical race theory. And I think its victory in the global culture war will be disastrous for Africa. And then the second point is, if you want to see what foreign policy can actually accomplish, look at the situation Bill Clinton handed over to George W. Bush in Kosovo, and look at the relative success that that area of the world achieved, because one president invested a lot of time in his final term, and then a second president took it over and developed and built on that foundation. Then compare that to what happened in Sudan when we went from the George W. Bush administration to Obama administration. George W. Bush is much loved in Sudan because he was such an instrumental figure.
South Sudan specifically.
In South Sudan specifically, in ending the Darfur genocide. And he was, in fact, the first global leader to call it a genocide. And kids are still today being called George Bush in South Sudan. But when the Obama administration came to town, the Sudan desk in Foggy Bottom, the headquarters of the State Department, sat empty for 6 months. George W. Bush handed to Obama the youngest African country in the world. It was a few months old. It had the potential to build up from the ground, from, you know, not an idealized situation, but it had so much potential. And Obama and the left couldn't care less. It had a lot of oil, but Obama couldn't care less. So if it's a contest between which party has been better for Africa and South Africa, I don't think it's even close.
Mm. I think just to clarify there, so Darfur is in northern Sudan, and Bush was an enemy of the Sudanese government, which has now actually been overthrown by a popular revolt. That was the government of Omar al-Bashir. But he was very influential, I think. I think that's a very good example. I think it's very difficult to tell. I think the likelihood, though, is that both presidents will largely ignore South Africa. I suspect that in a lot of ways, policy will continue to be driven by local bureaucrats rather than Washington in South Africa. And as a result, there'll be a lot of status quo no matter who wins. But I think your broader points about the sort of cultural battle are probably correct. Anyway, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful week. Cheers, everyone.